not to apply to the universe as a whole, but they wanted to have something like state, the quantum state of the universe as a whole, and then perhaps to attempt to integrate quantum mechanics with general relativity and other, and cosmology. And so this is the source of the origin of this. I think it's, I think that from this point of view, one can understand the initial motivation behind it. Mm. But as to explaining our experience, we need three further assumptions. First of all, that that we can, in order to explain what happens in systems and subsystems, we don't have to look at the wave function of the universe as a whole. We can define relative states. So this is one assumption. And here you have the definition of relative state. I don't think I should say something. I should repeat what a relative state is. But the point that I want to make here, and this is a well-known point, that the relative state itself, the relative state of a subsystem. So here, every even given any initial state, you can sort of break it into you look at the system and you look at the rest of the universe, so you can represent it as a kind of superposition or entangled state of what of the system and the rest of the universe. The rest of the universe may include us and our equipment and so on and so forth. And then you can write it in this form, which seems superficially like these are in which every state of the system is sort of coupled with the state of the environment or the rest of the universe in such a way. These are not orthogonal to one another, and they don't necessarily form a basis in the state of the complexes, the rest of the universe. And you can always write it in this way. It's not a bi-orthogonal composition because the EI is not, as you said. And each one of these terms is what's called a branch. So this is completely arbitrary, and this is the division of the universe into two parts. It's completely arbitrary. You can do it for every part and within the complement of that part. Now the second stage of the explanation has to do something with our experience, because these parts can be quite arbitrary, and indeed in the many worlds interpretation one can ask, why not take, a particle from here and a particle from somewhere on the other side of the planet, and a few particles from the sun, and a few from Andromeda, and a few from some other galaxy, and so on and so forth, and pick them and call them the system, and whatever is left, the rest of the universe, and break the world into a system and its relative state into the other. And what's so special about our experiences? And what's special about our experiences, what sort of counts for them in this story, and I don't want to go into that because this is also not subject to environmental coherence. So what you need here to the first step is to explain in what way our experiences are such that we see, why we see our measurement devices behave the way they do, sort of systematically, and why we see certain other things, that we see sort of the quasi-classical world of the classical, the world of macroscopic objects behave sort of like classical mechanics, or close to classical mechanics, or close to classical physics. And the answer is, has to do with environmental decoherence, which is a dynamical explanation, tells you that the way in which the environment or the rest of the universe is interacting with systems like us is to cause the things to appear, at least in the coarse grain version, to appear like classical. So this is second part, which I don't want to get. And let's assume that the story here is coherent. That one can tell a story about decoherence, which is coherent.
Sorry if you don't want to talk about this, but how do you invoke decoherence when we've assumed that the entire universe is a unitary Schrodinger evolution?
decoherence is part of the Schrödinger evolution of the entire thing. I mean, it's not, I mean, there's a Hamiltonian that drives everything, and this is just part of the Hamiltonian that drives everything.
Isn't decoherence by definition non-unitary?
No, decoherence is unitary. It's just a Hamiltonian. It's a Hamiltonian dynamic. And no, this is important here, because what happens with decoherence is not that part of the, one has to stress that, what happens with decoherence is not that part of the wave function of something going away or becoming zero or something like that. It's only that if you look at the relative state picture, a certain, what decoherence does is that from that it makes a certain choice of systems and subsystems, which is given the dynamics of these systems, given the dynamics of these systems with respect to the rest of the universe, then there's a branching, and we talked about what a branch is. This particular branching gives someone who is on the branch the experience of you know, looking at, you know, spin up or whatever. Getting into, okay? So this is not, the coherence is not something that sort of shuts off certain aspects of it. And one can ask whether perhaps there is some other dynamics that will allow for what I described before, you know, one molecule from here and one molecule from, and a few molecules from another galaxy and a third collection of some particles from a third galaxy and so on and so forth, also to have an experience of something like that. You know, I mean, and there's no a priori reason. Why not? I mean, depending on what kind of dynamic interactions you may have in the universe.
Yeah. Maybe just an answer to that, yeah, should be said. The decoherence applies to a subsystem. So the subsystem doesn't have to evolve unitarily.
Oh, that's true.
The assumption is that the entire system, the entire universe.
The relative state is that.
But I wanted to also...
Yeah.
I mean, I think you correctly criticized the arbitrary division into subsystems.
Yes.
And I think one could say it even more strongly because even leaving aside quantum gravity issues, we don't really believe that particles are well defined. That's it. Mm-hmm. We're really dealing with quantum fields here. Right. And as soon as you're dealing, your fundamental energies are fields, what would even be the meaning? What would be even a precise definition of a subsystem?
Right. Localization, because subsystems, for subsystems that make sense to us, we need some sense of localization, and fields cannot be localized such a way.
Well, yeah, the fields can. I mean, maybe you want to say a particular region of space, mm-hmm. But that's an extra level of arbitrariness, uh-huh. Because it involves a particular. It's a different kind of subsystem, right?
Right.
We don't stay put, we move around.
Yeah.
So I think people who espouse this don't seem to have really provided any clear definition of what they mean by a substance or what they would want it to mean in the context of quantum field theory.
Uh-huh. Okay, so that's. All right. Okay. Now the third story about which I wanted to talk, this is the subject of today's discussion, and it's possible today, is that what happens with probability? And why is there a special problem with probability here? And by the way, some people think that it's not a major problem for the many worlds interpretation. If we solve the other problem, then Now I think this is a very major problem from the just conceptually, quantum mechanics, I mean, this is what quantum mechanics give us and connects us to. This is the way quantum mechanics connects us to experience, to experiment, by giving us probability. So, I mean, any interpretation of quantum mechanics has to say something about these probabilities. You can't just put them aside and say, look, this is not a major issue in the interpretation. You know, if I know something about the other things, you know, let's forget about probability. Maybe they... And, you know, I heard that from some people saying, look, I mean, probabilities are not the main issue here. So there's, as if there's something, a greater aspect of it. Why probabilities are a problem? Because, you see, in the many worlds interpretation, if you think about the wave function, and we'll see in a moment, when there is some when there is some measurement, I mean, the development continues as if, you know, the development continues according to Schrödinger's equation. So there are many, many branches with many, many, with the outcomes of the experiment, and then there's a repeated experiment, something like that. Then it branches further and further. And you have this idea of a tree. But unlike a tree that you write down in a case of a coin toss, if you had a coin toss and you just wrote the tree of possibilities, there's one possibility, which is just one sequence of branches that you have to do. Is there some chalk?
Try to smash it.
I don't know. this one has one. Okay, thanks. Sorry. So suppose that this is exactly the difference. It's a conceptual difference that people sometimes don't notice. You know, because you have suppose that you look at something like what usually people refer to as branching, this kind of tree, and you say, okay, you toss a coin, you know, so you the first toss, you either get a 1 or a 0, okay, and then either you get a 1 or a 0, and so on and so forth. But it's only one path here that is actually realized, you know, there's only one path that is actually realized here, and the other paths just don't occur. But in a many worlds interpretation, this whole tree is developing, and each one of these branches exists, you know, and is real, is as real as all the other ones. So each one of the branches, provided it doesn't have sort of a zero coefficient, a zero amplitude, is real as all the others. And there is no a priori probability distribution over the branches. Because if you just look at the wave packet, you have these complex coefficients, the amplitudes, nothing in the world tells you that they have anything to do with process. There's one rule that tells you that if it's zero, then if the coefficient is zero, then the possibility that is described by whatever supposed to follow that zero never occurs. So this is a hint that there's something to do with probability, but there's no definite rule that tells you that there's some a priori measure over this tree of possibility. Moreover, there's an explicit statement that each one of these branches, or all the branches, they actually occur. They are as real, each one of these branches in the many worlds is as real as the other one. So therefore, you know, this is the a priori picture. You don't have Bohn's rule. You didn't put it in by hand. And you don't have a Bohn's rule. And you don't, then there is no connection whatsoever between the branching on the one hand and the probability, one of probabilities on the other. There's no a priori reason to assume that the branching is such that the majority, you know, that there's something typical. So there's no notion in particular, no notion of what is a typical branch and what is a non-untypical branch. As you would have in classical probability, you would have, or also in collapsed quantum mechanics, you would have. Because why? Because you know what the probabilities are for each one of those. So you know that this is p, this is 1 minus p, this is p, this is 1 minus p, and so on. And suppose that they are independent of one another, so you know that they are independent, and then you have a law of large numbers that tell you that branches of a certain height are typical, and the others are untypical. But here there's no probability a priori, probability, therefore there's no notion of what a typical branch or an untypical branch is. So this is an important aspect or an important question to the many worlds interpretation, is to actually provide us with such a notion of typicality and consequently of a notion of what is the proper sense of probability. And you would like them to derive Bohn's rule. So this is the third aspect of explaining our experience. Suppose that the other steps that have been taken are okay, then you have another. You have an altogether third aspect, and I think this aspect has never been completed. That this is something that has never been done correctly. Some people have sort of put probabilities by hand and say, well, we'll add another extra assumption to the natural interpretation, and that's the absolute, you know, the square of the absolute value of the coefficients is the wave back at our probability. And here I say this is another assumption. But deriving it, I think, sort of failed. And now I'll try to explain why I think it failed. So there are,
Just want to make a comment before I. It's my feeling that in this world, there is no real defender of many worlds.
Okay, so I.
That's my feeling. I don't know. But having said that, it's actually kind of. I'm the last person to defend. But it's kind of unfair because there's a long tradition in this picture of trying to provide.
I'll talk about.
Oh, you're coming.
This is the content of what follows. I'm not going to cover all the effects, but some effects, and I'll say something about them. Yes.
So my question doesn't sound provocative because there are no defenders. Is there any point in many worlds if you have to put the probability postulate by hand? Because my impression was that the main advantage and main idea of the whole program was to get away of postulating the collapse and the probability rule. And when you postulate it, you basically have usual quantum mechanics with a different power score.
Is
its impression correct?
That's my view too. But you know that the probability issue is really the crucial one. Now I'm not saying that I have a proof, you know, sort of a sealed proof that it's impossible to do that. I'm just saying that the attempts, the major attempts that I'm aware of trying to do that are sort of not succeeding, not successful, and I'm going to talk about that. That's what I want to survey here, yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering, well, this is related to Daniel's question, I think, but what would it mean to put in the Born rule by hand? Because that means to attach a probability to each branch.
Right.
But what does that mean if each branch is equally real, as you stressed? Does it mean that one is changing it and say, well, only one branch is real now?
No. They say, I don't know. I think there were attempts to say, look, there are branches, and now we want to define the subclass of branches, which is the typical one, in a certain way. But defining from the outside, by actually putting in probabilities in some sense. So all the branches are equally real, on the one hand, but some of them are more typical than others. Perhaps this is what, you know.
But then there's a missing link, which is to say our experience will correspond to a typical branch.
Right, so you have to say that too. I agree that this will not, but just, you know, deriving Born, you know, you can say, okay, I'll put it in hand, by hand, but then there's a whole story. What you're saying is that there's an extra story to tell. What's the relationship with probability in our experience?
There are attempts to Hilary Greaves, for example.
I'll say something about that. This is what I want to speak about and see what. So there are two ways to try to recover the problem. I mean, there are two ways. This is an explanation of what I was just saying, but in a more formal sense. So suppose that you make just n measurements. You had an initial state initial state up there is number phi, an initial state of a system which is the small phi, and the big phi is just the state of the, this is the usual way to present measurement, is the state of n apparata. So you can do the same thing if you have repeated measurements, or you can think about just measurements on equally prepared systems with equally prepared apparata. So this is just the initial state of the apparata. After you make n measurements, you get a state of that kind, which is just a superposition of the possibilities. And the measurement is, say, of some O, of which the psi are the eigenstate. And so you get such a thing. And the difference between the collapse postulate and so on and so forth, And the many words, the collapse postulate tells you that only one of those is realized. And the probability, and this is part of the collapse postulate, and it's the probability, which can be derived from some simpler axioms using Gleason's theorem and so on and so forth, is that this thing, you know, that the square of this thing is just the probability of getting this particular branch. And one of them only is realized, and that's what you actually see. And therefore, by the law of large numbers, this is just binomial, multinomial distribution, not binomial, but multinomial distribution. By the law of large numbers, you get in Born. But in the many worlds, six is it gives you everything. There's no extra assumption. So six is the state of, if you want, the universe. This is the five, the big five, so sort of the rest of the universe. Or just look at your equipment, and these are just the state of the system. And everything occurs. Every one of these branches, provided that the mu's are non-zero, every one of these branches occurs. So this is just the same. And there's no natural probability distribution over the branches. And that's an important thing to realize. Because one of the things that is misleading when you sort of expose the many worlds theory is really the idea that there's something to do with the branching process somehow giving you probability. Not only that, if you look at models of model of decoherence, even if you have just a two, if you have just a two-valued experiment, so that you can get, say, spin up and then down here, the branching is not necessarily just the two branches. But if you look at the decoherence process, there may be sort of a trillion of them, a trillion worlds to go up, and another billion and a half to go down. The numbers are finite. According, I think, to most theories are finite, but they have nothing to do. Then these numbers have nothing to do with the probability of spin up and spin down. So it's not even two branches. If you look correctly speaking, it's not even two branches if you look at the decoherence. So they are not even just two branches for an experiment that has two outcomes. There are trillions of outcomes, some of them are up and some of them are down. And the wave function is much more complex than what's written here. But so there are two attempts. Here are the attempt and solution. And they are following these two attempts are actually following in the footsteps of just classical theory of probability, attempt to understand what probability is. Historically, there are a few attempts like that, but two of them are sort of more mainstream and successful and cannot be dismissed out of hand immediately, and one of them is that probability is the limit of relative frequencies, and the other that the probability is the degree of belief. And for both of them, you have interpretation. Both of them sort of appear or pop up in the many worlds interpretation as possibility. So this is so the older one is the probability as relative frequency and limit relative frequency, and the newer one is the Bayesian one, the probability as a degree of belief. Where you can have, and I want to say what's the problem with Bohr. So let me just perhaps go with that. The relative frequency is really emerging. You know, the idea that probability is relative frequency, and that defend probability is relative frequency, quantum mechanics is really used in the heart of, and there's this law of large numbers that Hartle was formulating, and it says the following thing: suppose that suppose that we are just going to look at a case where you have actual infinity, or an infinite sequence of experiments. You need for that to work. You need actually to go to infinity. You can't stop at any finite end for this particular approach to work. So it's very much like. It's similar, one can say there's some aspects of that which are similar to attempts to derive classical probability as limit of relative frequency in infinite sequences, say the approach from Mises, if you want. So like, they assume that at the outset there is this experiment that goes on and on and on. We're just repeating the same experiments on the same state over and over and over and over again. And then you look at the infinite tensor product. Now, it's not important mathematically what it means. Actually, there are some complications where you go to infinite tensor products and so on and so forth that we sort of overlook here. And but there's also quite a bit of literature on that. Mm-hmm. Justification of that can be done. And so you're looking at a copy of the system, infinitely many copies of the same system with the same quantum in the same quantum state, phi. And then, suppose that you just look at the first n copies, you can define a relative frequency operator. You say, okay, suppose that I have some measurement O, and I repeat the measurement over and over again on each one of these copies. Then the relative frequency with which the kth eigenstate of O, which is psi k, appears can be given as an eigenstate of that particular operator in the following such. Just define that, and you see here you have an expression which just counts. Here you have the projections on all possible combinations of n of length n, capital N, of projections on the eigenstates of O, the psi. And here you have a number which counts how many times a particular psi k appears in that tensor product. And so if you look at that, this is an expression of an expression for relative frequency. Now it wouldn't work in the finite case because if you have different expressions like those, they will not necessarily. You have different expressions like that. You will not necessarily get the right result. I don't think that they're necessarily commutable enough for finding it. Or are they? They do. But in any case, if you want the law of large numbers, what you do, you look at this particular case, and you extend it by I to the infinite case, and then you look at the limit of that. You look at the limit operator, and the limit operator has the property that you really want, which means that the relative frequency of psi k in this infinite sequence of psi is really the one that is given you by the Born rule. So, meaning that this rk infinity, which is the limit of these relative frequencies in the space, which is an infinite product, tensor product, the limit of this relative frequency is a relative frequency operator, infinite relative frequency operator. And each one of these psi infinities, we don't care what phi it is, what phi is started with, each one of them is an eigenstate of that particular operator, and the eigenvalue is exactly what you expect from Born. Okay, so this is just a law of logic telling you that this is what happened. But what's important here is really the kind of limit. This is a crucial point that you get this operator as a kind of limit of other operators. So what you mean by the limit is really what makes this the idea of actually eliminating probability and defining it as relative frequency and recovering Born's rule as the relative frequency in infinitely many copies. What makes it problematic is really the circularity. Because you ask yourself, what is the sense in which this is really the limit of that? And the answer, this is the limit of that in the strong operator norm, which is defined by the inner product of the space. Since it's defined in terms of the inner product of the space, you sort of sneak Born's rule into the back door. So really the problem here of defining probability as relative frequency is really the classical problem that appears in all this. Circularity, sequence convergence in the strong limit, which is induced by the Hilbert space inner product. So you just assume that this is the right way of taking. Look, in the classical case, let me say something perhaps about the classical case, and you'll see that's the same thing that is happening there. If you look at the classical case, it's exactly the same thing. Because suppose that I toss a coin. Let's take a coin which is not fair, say it's biased, so it has probability of heads. It has P and tails is 1 minus P, Q. Okay, and you have a sequence like that. Let's call that 1 and that call 0. And you get a sequence of zeros and ones. Let's call it A1, A2. The This is just the sequence that you get. And you can ask yourself, okay, let's look at the relative frequency, the relative frequency of that, and then let's look at the limit. Now, we would like, for a sequence like that, of the bias point, a sequence that we actually get from a bias point, that the limit will be p, because this just counts the number of ones that there are in the sequence. But of course, you can't prove that this is true for every sequence, but you can prove that it's true almost everywhere. So why is it that good enough? Well, the answer is that you have to understand what almost everywhere is. And almost everywhere means with probability 1, meaning you just define the probability on the space of all possible sequences with a bias p. You take 0, 1, the omega, and you assume that all the throws, you know, all the tosses of the coins are dependent on one another, and the probability of heads in each one of them is p, and of tails 1 minus p, and you define probability space on the set of all infinite sequences, and then indeed, with respect to this particular probability, you can say that the probability that the sequence satisfies that is 1. But you have the notion of probability appearing here, and the notion of probability that appears here is really a notion that is undefined in terms of relative frequency. So it's circular to try to define probability as a relative frequency. It's exactly the same here, only that what you have here is the limit of operators, but you're using something like a measure of almost everywhere. Of course, if you just look at something where p is different from 1/2, you can say that, say for example, the combinatorial majority of sequences, if you just count how many sequences have frequency near 1/2, you see that it's usually that the up to, you know, a certain finite point n is certainly the majority. And from so why not, you know, why typical is this probability distribution and not another probability distribution? So you can ask that. And you can ask the same question here. Why typical is defined in terms of the inner product in Hilbert space? And the answer is because of Born's rule. But isn't Born's rule what you were supposed to derive? So this is really the problem with this approach, which is just the same old problem that you have in all over the place of trying to define probability of relative frequency. It comes back also statistically to the ergodic approach, because you have there a notion of almost everywhere, which depends on assigning the uniform measure on the relevant hyperplane in phase space. To identify as a probability measure, and that is not justified in itself by the ergodic theorem. I mean, justified perhaps by some other consideration. But you have to say in advance, you have to assume some notion of probability before you can prove that relative frequencies behave properly. Some notion of typicality. Now the question is that, is there a way to define typical sequences or typical sequence? This is a good question in the classical case, and it's also a good question in the quantum case, perhaps in many worlds. If you can define a notion of a typical sequence independently of probability. And in the classical case, there is a very long tradition of attempts to do that. That's a very interesting tradition of actually trying to somehow throw away the non-typical sequences by some principle which is itself not a probabilistic sequence. To say, look, you know, what do I expect from a random sequence which is biased towards me? First of all, that it will. Then it has some other characteristics. It has to behave in a certain way, the way in which, you know, say its relative frequencies sort of oscillate around the mean as it goes to zero, by, you know, in a certain very typical way, which is given by, say, by the law of iterated logarithm. It has to iterate in a certain way, and so on and so forth. So you want to have that picture, but not to say that it happens almost everywhere. You try to recover that picture without saying the word probability. So this is a very long attempt, a very long, you know, very old attempt, started with Whitman Regis, has very many problems to it, and I think all the first authors here up to Martin Lev were trying one approach, one particular approach. And Martin Lev was trying, you know, to define a set of tests that if a sequence passes the set of tests, then in the end you could say that it's random. But these tests themselves do not involve the notion of probability. So perhaps something like that can be done. I'm not saying that I know that something like that cannot be done in the many worlds interpretation, in the sense that you will say something about the sequence of coefficients and say, look, some of them are typical and some of them are untypical, but then you will have to add to that some notion that somehow we see the typical and the other, somehow connected to our experience. But there may be a notion like that. I know that people, that in statistical mechanics, for example, people like Shelley Goldstein was trying to derive a notion of typicality, which is not probability one, in order to say something about, you know, say something about entropy and so on, in a way that does not assume the increase of entropy and so on, in a way that does not assume probability. So this is not, by no means there is a sort of positive proof of something like that is possible. So this is one approach. And I would like just to go to the other approach we can talk about.
Before you go to
maybe
comment, maybe there is some gain here, although it doesn't lift the element of circularity entirely, which is that you somehow reduce the notion of probability to the notion of probability zero or probability
one. So you could. If you have some notion of what probability zero and one is, you're done, because you have a strong law of large numbers, and then you're done, or you have the ergodic theorem, you're done. So this is what typical means, have probability one. But somehow throw away the word probability out, which would but it's certainly true that probability one will do the job, probability zero will do the job. If you just know what probability one and zero is, you can do that, yes. And the same here, because it's all with probability one, probability zero.
Yeah, and people have these algorithmic notions that they're not obviously unsatisfactory, right? Whether or not they are a better replacement probability, you can argue that.
Yeah,
I think that they might work.
Right, and I think I can say something about that, because this is very much related to what I said here about von Mises and Martin Lev. These are for infinite sequences, but you can have them in the finite case with something like Kolmogorov complexity. So the difference here is that here in these approaches, it's much clearer. The relation between this effort and probability theory is much clearer than in the case of Kolmogorov complexity, where you have finite sequences, and so the relative frequencies are sort of oscillating, and how to define probabilities from them is not clear. For if you just look at Kolmogorov complexity, most of the finite sequences that have high Kolmogorov complexity also have very near frequency 1/2. So what do you do with, you know, T and 1 minus T? So you need, they certainly don't have maximum Kolmogorov complexity, because there's a sense in which you can predict the next one better than just 50-50 in such a sequence. If you know that it's biased towards P, so you know that P is, say, greater than 1/2, you know that you have a higher chance of predicting 1, or predicting that it's going to be half. So how to connect these things to a probability? It's a problem. People try to do that. I don't know if there's any satisfactory way to do that. But in the infinite case, this was actually motivated by probability theory.
But I was thinking some of these more algorithmically based definitions in the infinite limit could be argued to be satisfactory.
The question is how to take the infinite limit. It's not. It's very. It's a tricky. There's a tricky connection between the sequences that are random in the infinite case. You know, at the outset defined to be infinite and have that notion of randomness, and Kolmogorov and the Kolmogorov complexity, because you would assume, for example, that every initial segment of the sequence, which is sort of random in the infinite case, is going to have maximum, but it's not. It's oscillating. But you're right. I mean, this is a whole program that may succeed one day. And it may be applicable also in the Hilbert space case. I mean, it may be translatable. Probably it will be translatable also to the Hilbert space case. What's the outcome for that for the many worlds? I don't know. It's hard to tell. Because as you said, there might be other. So there's another approach. And the other approach is really looking at a particular, is really the approach that was developed by Deutsch, they think. Originally, maybe there were people before him. And then a sequence of papers came out with many authors. I think a lot of people are writing on that. And the idea is the following. Suppose that I am an observer. I mean, each time there is an experiment, there's an outcome of that experiment. And then there's another outcome. Suppose it's just a spin measurement, spin half particle. Then there are two outcomes. And there's sort of one copy of me on one branch and another copy of me on another branch. One copy of me speeds me up and the other spins down. But you can look at the history of each one of these copies, you know, as it develops. I mean, each one of these very multitude of copies has developed from, you know, when the observer was born. And then you can look at each one of these copies and each one of these sort of people who goes on. Or on one of these branches, and think about it as sort of having some kind of gamble on each. What would they do if they were to gamble on the outcomes of measurements? So they have, you have measurements. You measure this hole, and you measure this hole, and you have a game, and the game tells you, well, the system is in the state phi, let's say just pure state phi, and then there's the measurement pole. And the game consists of this phi and the measurement pole, and also the gains and losses that you will have depending on the outcome. So for each one of these outcomes, there's a number. Say the outcomes of psi I. So each one of these psi I's, there's a number xi, which is, say, the value in dollars that you're going to get or lose if psi I is the outcome. So this is a kind of game, it's a bet. You just translate the measurement into a language of a bet on a die or on a horse race and so on and so forth. So each one of the outcomes has for you some value, which is xi. And the idea, and this is the claim that has been proposed. Since the time the whole thing began, is that just by analyzing those gains in terms of A, quantum mechanics, quantum, the many worlds interpretation, that is, not in terms of the many worlds interpretation, B, decision theory, just axioms of decision theory, you can derive Born's rule. When I mean the many worlds interpretation, I mean that they assume that the observer who is sort of going on each one of these branches, each one of these copies, knows that the many worlds interpretation is valid. So an observer who knows that many worlds interpretation is that the many worlds interpretation is valid and uses decision theory, the canons of decision theory, non-probabilistic canons of decision theory, meaning just axioms of rationality. For example, the idea that you would rather earn money than lose it, something like that, or the canons of rationality that you prefer, you know, if your expected gain is bigger than in one game than the other, you prefer the one to the other, and so on and so forth. Or if you use just these, you can derive the Born rule, and how, in what way you derive, yes.
Believe
that branches are real, right? The wave function, the universe has its one state function developed according to Frederick's equation. That is the many worlds interpretation. All the rest are stories. That, as I said, all the rest are stories that that are told in order to convince you that you in this interpretation you still can have the experiences that you have, and it's all coherent with what you experience.
So I mean, what you said before could be replaced then by unitary evolution.
Unitary evolution.
And decision theory.
And decision theory. Unitary evolution plus decision theory. That's what I mean. Yes. Not. You don't have to. Yeah. All the stories about branching. So perhaps decoherence too. By the way. Perhaps you have to factor in decoherence. I think you should factor in decoherence too. So the evolution includes this particular, the particular Hamiltonian that does the decoherence. Okay. Yeah.
Another question here also that one sort of assumes that there's discrete outcomes, but I mean, even in a realistic situation, there would be a very, very small wave function where there was not either,
Right. The tails, what to do with the tails.
What to do with the tails.
So well, they don't say much about what to do with the tails, but, you know, let's assume that you're in the idea of, I mean, you're right. Yes, you know, I mean, what happens to in the laboratory when you get one of these tail results? What happened is that, you know, you usually say there was something wrong with the experiment, something moved, you know, I kicked the equipment by it. I mean, so I got this crazy result.
I mean, the reason I raise this is because already here there's an assumption of the board rule, right? There's this small tail in between, and there's the spin up and spin down outcome, right? And for some reason you say that only these two big clumps are important. Why?
Well, I mean, fine, you know, I think you're right. There is an assumption of Born rule at the outset built into the many worlds interpretation one assumption, which is the following, but it's there at the outset, and that is when the amplitude is zero, this will not happen. Which you can ask, you know, why too, but they assume it. This is one assumption of the many worlds. I mean, there is no copy of me going on a branch that has amplitude zero. Okay? I mean, this is something that is assumed by the manifold. It's part of the manifold interpretation. Which is also, you can say, why? Where does this come from? But you're right. I mean, so there's the idealization. But this is a very, I think it would be unfair, you know, to criticize them for something that everybody else is doing as well. So, I mean, there's this.
Well,
experiment the spin up and spin down, and these are the outcomes. You know, everybody says it. People with one information also says it.
I mean, so strictly speaking, that situation you described is when the real measurement you're making is a positive value measure. And you can completely accurately describe it within the PODM.
Right.
And I am sure that using PODMs rather than PD measures.
It will be the same.
It would change nothing.
Yeah. I think they can. And also, taking not pure states of mixture, which is also. So let's just move in this idea. I mean, they, you already have problems here, so they're sort of clear at the point.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Because these tails are not. I mean, there's this underlying assumption that the good answers, the answers that correspond to the kind of results that you want,
right,
the experiments you have correspond to sort of well-separated,
right,
branches. But I think part of Hans's point is that these tails are just smeared out. So
I mean, so
it's not like you could just add another outcome.
I mean,
no,
well,
right.
If this thing would be clean for me, if you're many worlds right, it would be like this. The tail is exactly zero, because there's no world
right
like that. And there's a clump in. Okay, I have a discrete outcome. Then that would be fine. But now the many worlds theory, I know that, look here, there's actually other things happening as well. So it's not a two-way outcome. So that,
right.
That's the wrong thing. I mean, and the way I think about it is you're creeping in a Born rule already here, but as we say,
I agree, I
don't think there's any justification for this to say that it's a discrete outcome at this stage.
I agree that if you just take the usual picture of a measurement, you do have these tails that go, this is sort of marked, and then you have these tails, but this is not strictly zero, and then since it's a many worlds interpretation, as long as it's not zero, it's there. You have a world in which this is the case and that is the case.
Okay.
And I agree that this is a problem. A problem. It's an additional problem. I didn't think about it.
It seems to me that it's a more serious problem than the problem arises in something like the ARW, because there the tails are potential.
Well, and the other tails really represent probability from the outset.
Here they are real.
Here they are real. And there, they do also represent possibilities, but with very small probability, because this thing, you know, the square of this thing is.
No, it was a possibility for us, for the person to experience.
Yeah.
But they are actually there.
They are actually there in the many ways.
Whereas in the case of the other,
they are not there.
They're not there.
They are not there unless something unusual.
It's just that they have potentiality of being.
Right. Oh, you're right. It's not the same as in GRW or just in any collapse field. You're right. I mean, this is an additional problem for them, because I think that's a good point.
Couldn't it be that one could just make the analysis more complicated? Once it's like, okay, it's really not that we have two outcomes. We have to include just that there's more outcomes. Also with the tail and three, and then also this thing.
Right, and then the expected utility formula. The expected utility formula will be sort of an integral of the possibility.
Yes, yes.
I don't know. You could do that. Yes. I think you could do that. But I think there are other problems, as I say. So what are these? I mean, so this is the idea. Now I'm not going to survey the way they derived it, because there are various ways in which they went. And as you go along, you sort of carefully analyze each step. And there are steps that were taken by Deutsch and then criticized, and done by Saunders, and then criticized, and done by Wallace and others. But I want to criticize one particular assumption that all of them are making. And that's, there are two problems with that. One of them is really a purely philosophical problem, but I think it's a major problem. And this is the problem that has actually been addressed. And that's the following problem. If I know for sure, you know, if I'm flipping a coin and I know that the result is going to be unique, it's heads or tails. And in the next minute, I'm going to find out it's heads. And then there is a sense in which I'm not sure what the result is, and I'm uncertain, and I'm going to bet on that. But in the many worlds interpretation, it's going to be heads, and it's going to be tails, and it's going to be, I'm sure, going to witness both of them. So in what sense am I betting on anything? I mean, who is the I here that is betting on the next step? Which is a kind of, what does it mean to bet in the many worlds interpretation? To have possibility? You don't have possibility. They are all, you know, they are all actualities. And if you don't, if you had some a priori notion of probability, then you would say, okay, it's a possibility, but it's a rare one, something like that. But you don't have an a priori notion. You just want to derive it now. So what is the sense in which you're actually gambling? This is a kind of philosophical problem. And what is the sense in which you have uncertainty about the outcome? There's no uncertainty about the outcome, because each one of the outcomes is going to be there. And not only each one of the outcomes is going to be there, you are going to be there to witness it. You know? So it's not. So it's there is a sense, and this is really the source of one of the papers that was written about that. That's the measure of caring.
The issue you raise here. What are the justifications of using decision theory? Because that's really used in different contexts.
Exactly. So this is the question. What is it that you're deciding about? So there's a lot of literature of that. I'm not saying they are trying to answer this question, because it's transparent. It's not a deep question that. So. They are trying to answer that in their decision theoretic. And there's another interesting answer about that it's not actually a decision that you're making about that. It's not a question about uncertainties, what will happen, but rather which copy of yours you care more about. So there is a whole story about which is the copy of you about which you are caring more. And you are trying to sort of, so this is a measure. So what the decision is about which copy of you you are, the measure of the gain or loss is not the gains or the losses are not in terms of the kind of utility that you have over, because you're not sure what will happen. Because you're going to live in a world where you're going to lose, and you're going to live in a world where you're going to win, and so on and so forth. But the measure there that is involved in the utilities is really a measure of caring. You know, you can think whatever you want about that, and I don't want to go into that game. I want to say just one thing, and that is that there is an assumption that all of them are making, and you can't avoid it, because otherwise you will not get off the ground in any case. And this is really a purely probabilistic assumption. It's not a decision theoretic assumption. It's not an assumption of rationality. So, and it's called the non-contextuality of probability. All of them are making it in one guise or another. Deutsch was not aware that he was making, or at least not in the paper. It seems to be unaware. It's just making a certain step in which he assumes it, a few steps in which he actually assumes it without explicitly saying it. What is the answer? Yeah, what is this? The non-contextuality of probability. Non-contextuality of probability is really something, the value of that, the expectation value of each operator, the expectation value of the operator is not changing when you measure it, say, alone, or measure it together with some other operator with which it is commuting. So, to put it, if AB equals zero and BC, say, equals zero, but AC is not zero, suppose again a situation like that, you have three operators, so that you have to measure AB. And then the expectation value of B, the one which commutes both in A and in any state whatsoever, is not, and we know that, it's a quantum mechanical rule, it's just a consequence of Born rule, that the expectation value of B, or the probability with which a certain outcome of B will come, is independent of whether you measure B together with A, which is called in context one. B with A. And context 2 is going to be B with C. And context 3 will be B with whatever it is, with I, with not doing anything else, just measuring B. Now, it's the expectations of B and all the probabilities associated with B, such as the probability of a certain outcome, small b, is independent of whether you measure it in one context or another. Now this is a rule, this follows immediately from Born's rule, but it's an interesting point here in quantum mechanics to point that out. There's some, because the values that you get cannot be non-contextual. This is the Cauchy-Lunsbecker theorem. Cauchy-Lunsbecker theorem tells you that if you have a B like that, then in general it's not the case that if you measure B with A, you would get the same outcome in a single. You would get the same outcome that you would get had you measured it in the different context. But the averages don't behave that way. Yes?
So given that increasing spirit tells us that the Born rule measure is the only measure on all the
spaces, assuming non-contextuality.
Consistent with non-contextuality.
Yeah.
So does this mean that in a sense, all the work really is being done by this assumption?
In all the papers, this is quite amazing, because in all the papers that derive quote unquote the Born rule from decision theory, there is an assumption that tan amounts to the non-contextual assumption. Now there is an argument there that says that this assumption is a decision theoretic assumption. And what I want to say here is it cannot be a theoretic assumption in any, in any circumstances. And the situation is the worst in the many worlds of the position. It's being not a non-decision theoretic assumption becomes the worst in the many worlds of the position. And why is that?
Is David Wallace the person who brought it out?
Wallace is the person who actually pointed out that this is actually there. But if you read Deutsch, you can see it there, because he's actually taking he's taking one game, one gamble, and he says, well, a person that bets in this gamble in this way will also bet in another gamble in the same way, and the only difference between them is that one in one A is measured with B, and in another it's just B is measured with A, and another B is measured with I.
Yes?
That's not a problem I have.
Yeah.
This business about so deriving a moral rule from decisions.
Right.
If we have a universe where there is some rational agent who's making bets and so on and so on, and some rules, maybe you can derive something about what this person do or believe or whatever. Okay. What I don't understand is, I mean, we observe intensities of spectral light emitted from atoms. The outskirts of a quasar was emitted a billion years ago.
Okay.
And the relative intensities follow the Born rule. And presumably, you know, I mean, most people anyway believe that, look, this light that's going through space millions of years before any rational agents existed on Earth, and maybe maybe the whole universe, no life, no now. You know, surely the question about the Born rule, or one aspect of it, is why did those atoms emit those spectral lines with those particular relative intensities? Now, I don't see how.
You see, but that's a different question with what the probability is. I mean, this is a different question. You see, it's like, here we are getting into a philosophical problem of what it means to have a Bayesian probability theory.
Hang on, but the Born rule predicts what those relative intensities are, and it agrees with what we see.
No, that's not a problem. Most, you know, it's very easy to predict, you know, what a sort of a flip of a coin is going to be like, and you don't need quantum theory for that.
But
this doesn't mean that probability is in the point.
Right, but the thing is, in the Everett interpretation, I'm trying to understand this in the Everett interpretation, I don't see how the decisions made by a rational agent on Earth billions of years later is relevant to
this. No, but it's not true. The many worlds interpretation, you see, the many worlds interpretation, because these spectral lines were obtained when there was a collapse of the wave packet. I mean, the photons went one way or another. I mean, they didn't have a they had a choice where to go. So suppose that you are living on a branch where you don't see spectral lines, which has it has positive probabilities, but you know, but all lines of emission then, you know, there's only one line of emission. They're all coming in the same frequency. Okay, it has positive probability. But this is a possibility too in the manual.
I understand that it's a possibility, but what I'm saying is I don't understand how decision theory.
No, here. So this is the connection. There are all kinds of sources of stuff, you know, okay, coming in. Now the question, what is a rational person going to do when that person has to bet on what will happen with this stuff? Okay? And it turns out, okay, that according to that, in the many worlds, but you can do it also independently of the many worlds, also in the usual one, it turns out that your best strategy is to use Born rule. If you have a judgment that it's, okay, this is also true in the actual world. Suppose that you were to go to the casino, and your judgment is that there is independent, you know, that there's no contextual, then Gleason's theorem will tell you how to bet. Okay? So this is the relation here. It's not just the probability, it also tells you how to bet and what to decide.
No, I understand. It's just I don't see the scientific problem of explaining intensities of spectral light can be reduced to betting.
This is wrong with looking at what programming. So I think the right way to look at the problem is, you know, the wave function gives you everything that holds you terribly, and that's the objective truth, that's how the universe is. But now, you know, billions of years later, humans find themselves in this universe and they're making decisions. How should they make decisions? That doesn't change the objective truth about the wave function billions of years earlier.
No.
It's just a simple question. How should decisions be made in the context of structure?
But it's the same question, because you're betting on the frequency spectrum, right? I'm going to do an observation looking at that.
Is that the way it really works?
This is the betting is really a metaphor. What you have to think is the following thing. You know, you have, I mean, it's the same problem outside, I mean, it's not the same problem. There's a similar problem outside of many worlds as well. I mean, also with collapsed quantum mechanics. Just the usual for Neumann, say, quantum mechanics. It has the same thing. You could think of the probabilities. You could think of or analyze the probabilities in terms of the following. I mean, there are all kinds of processes, things. And then you have your beliefs, and your beliefs are not arbitrary. They are sort of based on what you know, and your experience, and other people's experience, and so on, and textbooks. And you look at that, and you say, how should I bet on that? And if you can explain that the way you should bet as a rational person follows Born's rule, you sort of recover Born's rule in that framework. Now there's a different argument here, is whether this is the right way of looking at probabilities in the first place. Okay, but this is sort of taking us to a completely different realm. It's the foundation of probability, whether it's when and where and why Bayesian probabilities are okay. So, you know, but suppose that they are, and then the question is whether they can be used here. This is the question. Suppose that they are. Suppose that you have a notion of Bayesian probability. I happen to actually like Bayesian probability, so I mean, I'm not. But I think it's a sort of a different issue, right? Or it's just, and their idea is we can sort of this explain why an observer with a Bayesian is going to hit von Born. Yeah.
There might be, nevertheless, a point here that's not just related to Bayesian versus another.
Right.
Which is more related to prepared experiments in a laboratory versus assumptions of cosmological initial conditions, and the kind of situation that Anthony is evoking are really things where we don't prepare them, right? Whereas things were prepared by nature in some, you know, or by some previous quantum gravity or whatever it is that set the initial conditions for the Big Bang. And somehow when we actually use probability, when we actually do make predictions, many people have made this argument, and I think it's true, that we implicitly make a lot of assumptions about this initial state.
I think,
and if the paradigm in which this is derived leaves that out, it maybe is not actually addressing physics as we really do it, or not all of physics as we really do it, in particular cosmology. Is not being addressed. So
yeah. I
mean, there may be actually some gap there between what is even claimed to be true and what really needs to be true, if you want to give them a correct account of
look, I think reason. To be fair to the, you know, to the whole program here, I think to be fair to the whole program here, what they do is the following thing. I mean, I don't think what they do is the following thing. I mean, for them, if you take this Bayesian view, or you take this standing view of probability, the question is not what the probabilities are as some kind of thing that is induced from the initial state of the universe, but probability is a matter of your knowledge. So, given that you don't know the initial state of the universe, the question is whether there is a sense in which you can sort of recover the probabilities not knowing the initial state of the universe. And whether...
Well, I'd be very surprised if using just decision theory you could do that. That's what I'm saying. And I think that there's an input assumption that's really behind...
I agree with that. But I think the question is what other assumptions you need. And you know that from Leeson's theory. You don't need very many assumptions. You just need this... All you need really is decision theory and non-contextuality. Because Pardon me?
I think we're saying something different. Right? There's another assumption which does have to do with an initial condition.
And that's the non-contextuality.
Well, maybe it's, I don't know, that it can be just exhausted by non-contextuality.
I think that's the reason. Yes?
I mean, I think actually, in terms of the initial condition hypothesis, the initial state of the universe, then there's particular types of initial states of the universe that, as a pure state, are what we consider to be this low-entropy state.
Yeah.
And then there's high-entropy states, that is, hot, big, bang, black holes, evaporating black holes, that has initial conditions. That isn't justified from the point of view of... I mean, you can't make that decision in terms of which pure state the universe started out in. So I mean, this whole argument is given a pure state, how do I interpret probability?
Right.
So there are two different ways in which probability...
I see. Your question is, what is the probability distribution of over initial states of the universe as a whole, or...
Well, like, you could put it that way, I guess. But I'm just saying that some assumption of that nature goes into a lot of the scientific reasoning we do. It's especially clear in sort of geological settings or things like that. And if you find dinosaur fossils and you deduce from that there are dinosaurs, it's not this kind of reasoning using Born's rule alone or some, you know, conditional probability. There's an extra condition that's going on, something about the early, you know, the very early state. And so you have to be able to, I think you have to be able to just, if you want a complete, if you really have a practical point of view where you want to justify the way we think about the world, then it's just a partial view if you neglect that aspect, because that kind of reasoning goes into things we do every day.
Look, I think what you're saying is also formulated. It can be formulated in terms of the Bayesian approach, and it's actually partially given here. The idea is the following: in the Bayesian approach, you have two ingredients. You have the ingredient of the rationality of decision theory, and then you have the ingredient of what's called the prior, which is your the initial probabilities that you're giving before you learn anything, some kind of prior probability. Now, the prior in the Bayesian approach is not part of rational choice. It's something that can be anything that you want. Now, if a person, you can think about a situation in which the prior is such that will not support, even in the Bayesian case, will not support a conclusion from finding, you know, a dinosaur bones, that there was a dinosaur there. And we know many people who do not conclude that from that, right? And this is very well within. So I think the initial state of the universe is really the prior here, you know, which plays the role of the prior in the quantum game. And then if it has low probability, if it has low entropy, you have one consequence of another. Now there are, I think, this is not so much related to what we are speaking about, but I think that there are some results that I think very significant results. I think one of them is by Popescu and collaborators, and other results by I think similar results also by Goldstein and collaborators on what happens for almost all pure initial states that you take. If you look at a subsystem which is sufficiently low dimension relative to the universe as a whole, then the reduced state will be uniform. So it will look as if, you know, the initial distribution for an observer in a sub, it's just the uniform distribution, and it starts to learn from there. He or she starts to learn from there. So in this respect, it's not. Many of these results do not depend, you know. I mean, it has nothing to do with what I say here on the many worlds. But in this respect, it does. Many of the things that you do say do not depend. You can start off from something like a thermodynamic, initial thermodynamic state, and then you learn something new and you conditionalize on that. Okay. So you start from sort of blank, uniform blank, and you'll get the same result. Quite independently of the initial state of the universe. So suppose that you start from a blank and then you see up and down. And you just say, well, now I know that it's been up.
But I think a result like that was proved by Elliot Lumpkin many, many years ago. But I don't think that that's going to...
Oh, it's not going to do all this.
I don't think that's going to do the job.
Yeah. So my actual just reaction to that is that it's very much like the prior, I think. You're choosing the initial condition. So I don't know if I think I lost my time. But just to say that, maybe I'll just say that. And what I wanted to say is that it can't be, but this is not something that is quantum mechanical. This is what used to be called judgment of relevance. And the many worlds interpretation in particular, in the many worlds interpretation, but in particular, you have a problem with that. with the non-contextuality of probability. And the reason why you have a problem with non-contextuality of probability is that you are going to have many branches on which probability is contextual. And you can't say that there are non-typical a priori. And this is the point here, that it's not only that you assume something which is not probabilistic. Any decision theory which is probabilistic. Any decision theory makes assumptions that are probabilistic because you make judgments of relevance. You decide that the moon is irrelevant for the judgment of whether the coin is going to be up, you know, the state of the moon is going to be up or down. And you decide, and you don't factor the moon into your probability space. You make these decisions all the time, and these are not rationality decisions. These are decisions that are made on your based on your knowledge. And they're empirical, because it so happened that this is the world you're living in. But you can only call them empirical. But in the many worlds interpretation, you know, there are worlds in which the moon does influence the coin.
Some say this is one of them.
Yeah. Okay. Or whatever. And there are worlds in which there is a very strong correlation between your character and the month that you were born in, you know, the sign that you were born in. That is really very good. I mean, there are words like that. Yes?
Suppose we have the following scenario. We have we start with a billion experimental devices.
Right.
And in each you measure A together with B or C.
Right.
In your example,
yeah.
It would be with A or C.
Right.
And so in each experimental rate, we do. So I'm just trying to see exactly you claim that there are non-contextual statistics. How would you see that?
Oh, the following thing. Suppose that the expectation value of B is 1/2.
So would you say then that if you follow a tree up there and you collect all the relative frequencies?
Right. No. Exactly.
You would see.
No, you take a branch of the tree in which suppose that the expected value of B is just 0. Okay, B has an expectation value is just 0. Okay. But you just collect a branch when it has two possible values, 1 and -1, okay, and the average with probability that you average it. And then suppose there is a branch such that whenever you measure B with A, you'll get +1, or most of the time you'll get +1. Mm-hmm. And whenever you measure it with C, you get -1. So you are an observer going on that branch. You will say, oh, I mean, the expectation value of B depends on whether I measure it with A or not. Right.
In each branch, you do a definite experiment. You either do
yeah.
A or C. I mean,
right.
You do both, right?
Right.
So how do you get that in that you could actually see this not contextuality?
No.
Are you making both experiments?
No. I'm making one experiment. Now, what will happen to a typical observer, according to if Born rule is right, is that you will see that you're making the A and you're making the B, and then you sort of separate them and say, okay, let's take the subset of experiments that I made together with A. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that the expectation value there is 0. And then you take the subset which you measured with B, and then you see that the expectation value is 0. And then you come to the conclusion that the expectation value is not, you know, is not dependent on whether I measure it with A or with C. Okay? So this is the typical experience.
Yes.
But you can be on an untypical branch not having that experience. And there's no a priori probability that tells you that this is an untypical experience in the manual interpretation.
So during one of these when you move along one of these trees, you may repeat the experiments of P with A and B with C.
In any order, whatsoever.
And then you collect the subset, and you will
right.
Together with A, and you look at the statistics for B.
Right.
And then you do the same for C, and then your statistic energy, it's contextual.
It's contextual, exactly.
And it should probably also be the case that it's, for the majority, overwhelming majority of words, it's contextual. I think that one can
that I don't know, majority in the sense of combinatorial majority?
Exactly, yes.
I don't know if it's a combinatorial majority. I just say, I don't know, I mean, if you start with that, you open a kind of Pandora box. Mm-hmm. Because I had that experience with that argument with Simon Saunders, because I told him, look, but there may be a majority of those, like just in a combinatorial sense. He said, yeah, but that, you see, you don't know how many branches you have in each experiment. Even if you just have two possible outcomes, there may be trillion branches going there, this one way, and 100 trillion going another way. So what sense is this a majority? So I don't want, you know, I'm just saying, look, I don't know whether it's a majority or not. All I know is that there's no a priori distribution on that. So you don't know whether it's typical or not. Why is it atypical? So this line of saying that this, you don't even have a good argument why in the many world interpretation the non-contextuality is a reasonable judgment. You know, I can tell you that my judgment that the coin is independent of the, you know, that what the coin will happen to the coin is independent of the moon is a reasonable judgment, okay? Because it's based on experience and so on. In the many worlds interpretation, you don't even have an argument that says that it's a reasonable. I mean, all such judgments are empirical. They're not purely decision theoretical. So they're based on experience. But in the many worlds interpretation, they're not even reasonable. A priori. They're not even reasonable a priori. Because you may have this experience and may not have it. So I think this is a problem. And once you assume that, I didn't go into their argument, you know, the argument of Wallace, why he thinks that it is a principle of rationality. I used to think that too, that you could come up with an argument why non-contextuality is can be rationally supported, but I don't think that anymore. I don't think that is working. Okay. Yeah.
There was a criticism of Wallace by Hugh Price.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the criticism was, but from the hashtag I remember, it was he was accusing Wallace of circularity. Now, what I understand is you are accusing him of inconsistency rather than circularity.
No, not inconsistency. I think what I'm saying, I mean, against Wallace, what I'm saying is in particular that indeed you can derive Born rule, but not from decision theoretic axioms. One of his axioms cannot be a decision theoretic axiom. It's not. It's an axiom about a judgment about the world. You know, judgment about the world, and since so he assumes that certain regularities hold the world in a certain way, not others. So it's not a purely rationality axiom, like you know. You prefer. You know, you prefer to have larger utility than lower utility, whatever that means. You know, I mean, if utility is money, you prefer to earn rather than lose. If utility is being a good person, you know, there are situations where you prefer to lose rather than win. But okay, but then you utility other utility. So it's not an axiom like that. It's an axiom. It's an axiom about the world. Yes. Yeah.
I'm actually gonna say surely it is actually what you just said stronger than the circularity. It is actually stronger than you just said. Because you make the point that the non-contextuality is not a decision theoretic assumption. It's something you make on the basis of criticism. But if I am a good Aeretian, then I know all my future selves are going to exist. And I in fact do know that they're going to be future selves, which are not going to be a non-contextual world.
Okay.
So as an Everettian, I can't assume non-contextuality because I know there are future selves that are not going to experience a non-contextual world.
But if you have an argument, you don't have it, but if you have an argument that says that there is some notion of typicality and you're on it, and then there's a good, it's good to assume that you are on a typical branch, then you wouldn't. So you see, it's really all hangs on that you somehow throw away all these deviant branches, you know, somehow. And if you could, it would be nice. I don't think you can. You can only do it on the basis of experience. And experience, you don't have the right experience in many cases. So this is the point. But you're right. You know, if you only know that it's going to be one of these Everettian branches, and there's no a priori probability of which one it's going to be, then why should I assume that it's going to, that contextuality in the first place? Because it may very well be not the case. It, you know, and more likely it will not, I mean, perhaps it's contextual, but not satisfying Born rule. I mean, just contextuality is not, you know, okay, yeah.
Well, I mean, in that point of view, I mean, is it not the case that I mean, within the Bayesian point of view, there's the kind of the subjective Bayesian, there's the objective Bayesians. He's very much working the kind of the approach of the objective Bayesians, and they're trying to come up with a rational rule. The subjective Bayesians say, well, in terms of things like decision theory and Dutch book arguments, you really, you can't actually tell this because of the prior experience. You can't actually tell.
Right.
And that anything that's just consistent in terms of the common ground axioms across branches, however, will be a valid probability measure that's in, immune to Dutch book arguments. So
but
you have to be bringing something in addition to decision theory or Dutch book arguments, because otherwise you can't rule out all the other.
That's true. I think that's true. I think one way to say it is that this judgment of non-contextuality is actually part of the prior subset. You're making it a part of the prior. And it's true that if someone, what they're saying is, if someone, for some reason, chose a prior which is non-contextual, they're going to learn, I mean, they may learn vulnerable because the probabilities may yet not be vulnerable. But I think decision theory, you know, if you just think that we have one world at every junction when you have a choice and there's a coin can come up and come down and there's only one possibility that not both possibilities are realized. So there's you're actually going on one branch and that's it. Each branching you're just going on one of them. Then the following happens. In many cases, no matter what prior you choose, almost no matter what prior it is, provided that you're not giving zero probability to certain things, you're going to converge. So for example, if you have a coin, and if you're not too dogmatic and assume that the coin has probability 1/2 and everything is independent, then you're not going to learn anything. Or you're not assuming that probability of heads is zero, you know, something like, if you're not taking these two extremes, you take anything in the middle, after a while, you'll get to the frequency of the point as your probability, very close to the frequency of the point as your probability. So the Bayesian approach, although it gives you some freedom in the choice, a lot of freedom in the choice of prior, for most priors will behave okay, you know, after a while, because two people with different priors will get to the same point. Yeah, this is definitely assuming something like, you know, assuming something like exchangeability. So assuming that the world is regular in some sense, so exchangeability. So with that you have it. So even in the definitive or subjective view, there's a misleading, I think, sort of aspect about the subjectivity. The subjectivity is not that strong because it's under two or three assumptions about, you know, quite reasonable assumptions about the world, everybody will tend to agree with if you have a repetitive experience.
From that point of view, then, if you didn't use the non-contextuality in the argument and you come up with any non-born rule probability of priors, if you then update in a Bayesian sets, then on those ever-ending branches in which it actually seems to follow the truth, those people would actually end up converging on believing in born truth.
Right. I think that's true. Unless they're giving zero branches that are non-zero. Because just conditionalization will not uplift you from zero to positive probability. But other than that, that's true. Other than that, it can be learned. You know, it can be learned if you have reasonable prior. And the world is doing what it has to do. I mean, otherwise, if the world doesn't do what it has to do, then you will not learn the right rule. I mean, it seems to be, I mean, it's like a truism. If coins, you know, now the question is what would you do? I mean, the question is what will you do if you have the following experience? This is the really sort of the Bayesian question. What will you do if you have the following experience? You flip a coin 70 times, and 67 out of 70 times it comes heads. What is your reaction? A, the coin is biased. B, this is just a fluke. The coin is not biased. It's half and half. And this is a fluke, and it's possible. If you assume independence, you know, that each, and you think that it's, the coin is not biased, then it is very well maybe a fluke. You know. And if you use the rules for learning, you'll not learn anything. You'll just say, oh, the next flip is just half and half. It so happened that I had these 67 ones. But if you're a bit and you learn from experience and you will update it and you say, well, I mean, this point is heavily biased. So I think that if you live in a branch which is born-like, and you start your initial, you know, your prior is such that allows you to learn, you will learn, you know, eventually. This is it. And you assume something like that one experiment is not independent, but at least the order of experiments doesn't matter. They are exchanging.
Well, you could find that in the first 100 trials, you have the 0-1s of the binary expansion of pi.
You could, yeah.
Then what would you do then?
Most people would not notice it. They think that it's just random. Who knows the first 100? I mean, some people do. Yeah. But you're right. This is true for every sequence that has some not very complicated rule. Some rule which is less than 100 digits long.
And then you might bet and find you won $1,000 through betting in that way. But really, that would seem to be a rational way to have done it, in that if people argued against it according to Bayesian ideas, then the thing they'd have to say, I suppose, would be you're going to lose out, really. Someone will make money out of you. But, I mean, that assumption is then, I suppose, if you went along long enough with this strategy, that's what would happen. It seems you're close to then getting into a circular sort of argument.
No, I mean, I don't think the Bayesian sort of rules out the possibility that if you got lots of ones, there was no bias and it's just fluke. But they sort of more tend to the idea after, not immediately after the first three or four, but after 100 tosses and so on, they tend to, and I think justly so, to the view that there is a bias, and so they correct for the bias in their prediction of what will happen. But there's no guarantee, there's no Bayesian rule that tells you that this is the right thing to do for sure, because it may have been a fluke. I mean, the Bayesians will allow that it's a fluke. But I think, you know, everybody will sort of suspect if you start to see irregularity that is against just randomness. So if you see that these are the development of pi and so on, you will allow it to be a fluke for 10 digits, 11, 12, or later on. And I think that's the Bayesian view is that you have to suspect something else. Anyway.
Better make sure we are on the branch of the universe which makes us end in time and time.
Yeah, good. There is a stopping rule.
Yeah.
Okay.
Start the day so we could, of course.
Yeah, okay.
So, before people go, some of us are going to dinner tonight, so if you'd like to join us, please let them go to the nap. When are we going? Sorry, what's it? 7 o'clock. And I have to put the table straight. I'll quickly hand it to
the question is where,
I don't know, because I don't know if they're available. But I will go up my hands first and solely this. So,
yeah.
And
you
have one.
Yeah.
What was that?
I think
one, two, three.
I think I'm pretty sure.
You count me too. And the aura, my watch.
And Anthony.
So what was that?
And
Leora.
And Leora.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like 8
or 1.
Do they know what uncertainty is in the restaurant? I mean, they should. There is some uncertainty in the number.
It's a week there, so that should be
an experience.
Yeah.
Christian, do you want to come?
Yeah, I can go. Okay. Last thing is on my part, if anyone has anything half quarter, three quarter paid to offer, let me know. Next session, I suppose, it will be after next on Thursday. So, whoever has something.
In Ellis room, I presume. In Ellis room.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to the next one.